Thank you, Steve. Under rainy skies, it's a good day to be indoors drinking a little coffee this morning. Have with us this morning Newt Griffith from Manson and Ed Armbruster. I want to welcome the two gentlemen along, and we thought we'd talk a little bit about the Manson area this morning. First of all, Newt, when did your family first get involved here in the Lake Chelan area?
My family came up here. We came up and bought the first tract in 1914, and then the family moved up here in 1915. And I stayed in Wenatchee and came up here in 1919.
Now, where was your family's place? Where was it located?
Well, you know where Sid Burns lives?
Okay.
That was it, right there. And Pittman Brothers own it now. It's on Swartout Road.
Mm-hmm. When you came here, did you go right into the orchard business?
Oh, yeah. Well, started from scratch. Cleared the ground and broke it up and set the trees there in 1915. First trees in 1915.
Okay.
And then had only a 10-acre tract to start with. But we added two various tracts on each side of it, above and on each side of it. So we finally wound up with something, well, my two brothers, my dad and I, we finally wound up with approximately 100 acres that we developed out there.
That's a long ways between starting with 10 and winding up with 100. How long did it take you?
About 7 years.
All of it cleared yourself?
Well, some of it had been cleared, had been farmed, dry land farming, wheat. But a lot of it was just open hillsides and had never been anything, only just what the cattle chewed off was all.
Yeah, yeah. Was that what they called dry land orchard then?
Oh, no.
No?
No. The old land company had platted that ground out there and were putting in a water distribution system in there, and the area that we started in on, they had the first water in there in 1914, so then we started from there, and as they put in distribution system to get water to it, we added to as they were able to build their distribution line to take care of it.
And I've seen pictures of what is now the Manson area back from 1907, 1908, 1909. If you look at those pictures, it doesn't look as though anything could exist out there. Well, who was responsible for you know, getting things going in that area?
Well, originally, of course, it was all Indian reservation out there, up to a certain line. And then above that, it was open homestead land above the reservation, the old Columbia Reservation line. Above that was all homesteads, and that was all dry land farming. Below the reservation line, there was some little farming that the Indians had done in there, and they had leased some of the land out to various ones for pasture and a little hay and what have you, but no irrigation. There wasn't any irrigation in there. On the first irrigation was off the old low line one. That's the one that came out of Wapato Lake and comes east towards Chelan. That is the first area that was developed.
Who was responsible for starting that irrigation project?
Well, it was actually what they call the Lake Chelan Land Company. a bunch of my man from Seattle. That was Joshua Green, and Roy Backus, and Calvert, Swartout, and Swallow. There were people that were all connected with different banking outfits in Seattle.
Yeah.
And was capitalized, I think, at about $200,000, something like that, was just capitalized.
That was a lot of money in those days, $200,000.
A lot of money. And they bought up the first, before that, before they came in here, was sort of a local bunch that had filed some water rights on Wapato Lake, and some of the creeks up old Mitchell and Golden up in there for a feeder deal. And then they had bought all land around 4th July Mountain up in there, Antelin Lake area. Some of those old homesteads in there to get right-of-ways to put their ditch in. Mm-hmm. And they bought old Bill Antelin place, Temple place, and Johnson's. And then they got down farther, well, down to Joe Creek. But then mostly they put in got easements across those lands, but for the easements, usually they just give them water rights.
Yeah.
So much water for. And then when the land company came in here, I think they came in 1910. They bought this old original Wapato irrigation outfit out. They're all their rights and easements and stuff that they had. And that's really when then they proceeded to buy up the Indian allotments in the area. And didn't buy them in all of them, or very few of them, but they got all the land was in each allotment. Those allotments run about 596 acres per allotment. And in some places they bought the whole allotment, but mostly they bought, and the Indians retained 80, some of them 80 and some of them 120. And they got so much for their land, and a water right for their land, 18 acre inches per year over what was the period from
June to
October, wasn't it?
Yeah.
June to October,
four months.
About 4 months that they were entitled to use ditch water.
Mm-hmm.
And their rate was $2.50 per acre that they were supposed to pay for maintenance.
Yeah. Talking this morning with Newt Griffith, Ed Armbruster's with us too, and we're talking live from the crockery again. We'll take a commercial break here and then we'll come right back. Thank you very much, Steve. We're talking this morning with Newt Griffith and Ed Armbruster about some of the early development of irrigation in the Manson area. Newt, you were talking with us about the first irrigation ditches coming out of Wapato Lake. Now, they went in about 1910, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And how long did that original system exist? do you know?
Well, the land company came in then and bought the old irrigation or the old Wapato outfit out in 1911, or late in 1910. And they started operation then in 1911. Started platting the ground, buying up these different allotments, and platting and laying out and surveying out the various tracks and laying out roads and such as that over the project.
How much of an area did that first Wapato project cover?
Well, the first Wapato, probably covered around, I think around 700-800 acres.
Okay.
And then when the land company came in, the old land company came in, they finally wound up with approximately 5,500 acres.
What was the system like? Was it just open ditches that were dug?
Open ditch and box flumes.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the major pipe was the old, what they call the Manson siphon. And that came around the hill from Joe Creek to what we call the Rochester Box. First it came around out of Wapato Lake, or out of Anlin Lake, and then it was divided at Stanford Place, and part of it went east and part of it went west. And the stuff that went west went through the Manson siphon. That was a steel pipe. And
he's got some notes on it here somewhere that he's looking up. It's about 18 minutes now past 9 o'clock from KOZI Chelan. Talking this morning with Newt Griffith and with Ed Armbruster about irrigation in the Manson area. Ed, how long did you spend with involved in the reclamation department out there? When did you start?
I think I was elected to the board of directors in 1956. I believe that was the time. And then at that time I was working at the Forest Service. One day in about 62, I think, Ken Blair, who was forest supervisor, was up, and we walked out on the lawn and said, "Don't want to talk to me." And so he said, "I would suggest that there's a possible conflict of interest with your work here and being on the board of the Reclamation District," since there were some spatial use permits and a few other things there. And he said, "I would suggest maybe you like to get off the board at the Reclamation District." And I told him I thought that was the best idea I'd heard all day. And so then I did. And then I started working as assistant manager in March, I think it was, 65, and then as manager in January of 66.
When you went to work there on a full-time basis, how much of these old systems we've been talking about were still in operation? Were there any of them that were still there?
Well, they were all in operation. I think some of probably the original pipe in this Manson siphon that Newt's talking about, I'm sure some of that, there's a lot of riveted steel pipe in there at that time. Mm-hmm. The low-lying ditch, of course, was still there from Wapato Lake going east on Swartout and also coming back toward Manson. It split there at Roses Avenue and Wapato Lake Road and came back that way. I think the whole system, of course, Newt hasn't gotten yet to the part where they will curve back up into the hills, but of course all that system was still in. I would say the only change in the system had been from that time. Of course, we'd added a few pumps in Lake Chelan. Every time we run a little bit short of water, took on some more acreage or something, we'd add a pump someplace and try to work that way from it. But it was all still there.
It must have taken an awful lot of maintenance for a system that old to continue to function, huh?
Well, yeah, it took a lot of maintenance. I mean, you expected a lot of maintenance, and when you have old wooden pipeline and old steel pipeline and concrete ditches. And one thing I was fortunate, we still had quite a bit of wooden flume left at that time. And fortunately, we got out of most of that business when we did. We replaced a lot of it on these, what's known as the East High Line up in the higher part. And also They had some half round, which was half pipe. I mean, just like pipe with steel band except half. We replaced that in the winter of 67 and 68. I think we put in pretty close to 20,000 feet of steel line. I don't know. We had quite a discussion whether to replace it or not. I guess things were with us because in the summer of 68, we had a 4th of July mountain fire that would have taken off, would have burned out all this 20,000 feet that we replaced the spring before. So we thought we got the entire use out of that pipe we would have, or all that wooden flume that we could have.
Yeah, yeah. Newt, did you find what you were looking for there?
Well, I've got something here to clear up a few of those points here. The Wapato Irrigation was sold to the Lake Chelan Land Company in April 1911. Mm-hmm. And that sale, then the land company, Lake Chelan Land Company, made a division then and turned the water over to what they call the Lake Chelan Water Company in June 1911. And there was 5,000 acres then. Water allocated 5,000 acres, one share per acre. And that is supposed to be equally divided, and each acre was supposed to get a certain amount of water, their equal share. And then the Lake Chelan Land Company, then they got into financial difficulties, and they filed bankruptcy in October 1917. And then, of course, was operated then under a bankrupt trustee until 1920. But in the meantime, the bankrupt sale was held in June 1920. And the old land company sold out all their water rights and lands and everything they had in the area here. The bankrupt sale was for $350,000. Sold to New York and Philadelphia. Baker and Kennedy and that bunch. They bought the old land company out for $350,000. Then the Lake Chelan Reclamation District was formed in June of 1920.
Who formed it? Who was responsible for that?
What?
Forming the district.
Well, it was just a case of community effort, I guess you'd call it, because the fellows that were trying to work it out, they were all contract holders or landholders out there, and I can't name just who all was in it. I know Dr. Bowes was one of them, and a fellow named Swank, and Cushmaw.
So basically then it was an effort among people who were trying to operate out there to assure their own water supply.
They already had their orchards in, and it was just a case of getting water, and that's one way to get it, and going under state rule and regulations, there were certain filings that had to be made, and besides that, and then the board of directors elected or appointed to operate it. The
Newt, when it came to putting a water ditch alongside somebody's land, I can understand how that would be done. What did the grower have to do to make use of that water? What kind of a distribution system did he have through his own orchard?
Well, they tried to deliver water to the high point of each tract.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a measuring box put there, and then the water was run to that box and went over what they call the cipollary weir to measure the amount of water.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember right, on a 12-inch weir, 2 1/8-inch depth over the weir, over a 5 to 7 day period, would give you your allotted amount of water for one irrigation.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have the modern sprinkler systems that we have now.
No, there was no sprinklers. It was all real irrigated. But I don't think there was any sprinklers put in there until, well, probably in the 30s.
Well, what did you do? Did you just let the water run down through the orchard whichever way it wanted to, or?
Oh no, you had your flume or something with your outlets in the flume.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had your little rill ditches that you plowed out or hoed them out or shoveled them out or anything so that you had enough grade the water would go through.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I've done a lot of it by hand and some with a mule and some with a tractor.
One thing Scott, I might say, and I've read back through the minutes a couple of times, go back when the district was formed, it's very interesting and it gives you a little bit of back history, but in those days when Newt said they had water for 5 or 7 days, that's what you meant. That's what they meant. You had so much water and you got it for that period of time, and if you didn't get your orchard irrigated in that period, that was just tough luck. I mean, they were very strict. The water was very limited supply, and even in some dry years they would cut back a little bit more. So you really took care of your water, and you didn't, if you had any extra tail water came down and you're running you off into the road or along the edge, the ditch walker would come around and let you know about it, and he'd cut you back some more, because water was very carefully used in those days.
I think it was closer monitored right then, and it has been since they've gone into the sprinkler systems and trying to meter it out, and the meters don't work. And
you talk about 5 or 6 days of water. That's for the entire growing season?
No,
or?
That'd be for one irrigation. You was allowed 3 of those during the season.
Okay. Who decided when you could have your 5 or 6 days?
The ditch walker.
Okay.
The guy that was running the ditch, he was the guy that told you. He knew how much water he had and how many acres he'd cover.
Okay, so it was up to you to get your own little system in your orchard prepared and have it ready when he said so.
Yeah, and you didn't know what time that was going to be. It might be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, it might be 2 o'clock in the morning. When the time for you to take care of water, well, you wanted to be ready because you were going to get it. If you didn't take care of it, you were cut off. There's no fooling about it. The guy that was running the ditch, he was, you might say, he was boss. He told you how much, he knew how much you were allowed according to law, but he knew how much he had in the bucket, and that's how much he could divide out.
And sometimes they were in conflict, I suppose. It's about 9:30 or so, and we'll come back and talk some more about irrigation systems in the Manson area in a moment.
Modern conveniences. Wow. No, they had to be very strict. I mean, that was it.
Sure.
That was it. There wasn't any extra.
Thank you, Steve. Ed Armbruster and Newt Griffith are here with us, and we've been talking about getting the irrigation systems going in the Manson area. Newt, so far we've only mentioned in any detail at all the first little system that was put in 1910. Certainly there's a lot more than that that started breaking loose about the time that you came here in 1920, wasn't it?
Well, you're right, the Wapato Dam was put in 1910 and 11.
Mm-hmm.
And the Manson Siphon, that is that big pipe that I was talking about, from Stanford's across to the West Ridge, was 1910. Now that was 24-inch riveted steel pipe. Wasn't welded, it was riveted steel. And the low-lying ditch was built in 1910 and 11. That took care of, well, everything under about 1,200 foot elevation, 1220. And then they built the high line. That was to take everything above the 1,200 foot elevation. And that was started in 1911 and 1912, and supply line was built from Andelin Lake into the hills to pick up the creek water. That was started in 1911 and was finally shoved through to pick the pickup to Grade Creek in 1914. That was a supply line to bring water down to Andelin Lake. And then from then on, of course, it's just a case of, as the land was developed, they developed the distribution system to go to it, to take the water to it.
There was a system built to draw more creek water into Andelin Lake, is that what you're saying?
The old supply line, yes.
Okay.
That took in Mitchell Creek, Little Gold, Big Gold, Poison, Little Grade, and Big Grade first. And then along 1925, dry years hit, and they decided to go on in, so they went on into Falls Creek. And then in 1925, there's 22, I guess it was, they went into Falls Creek. In 25, then they went into Safety Harbor. And that was all, most of it was just flume on stilts on the hillside and on a certain grade, about a 0.5-1% grade.
How much water was pulled into Andelin Lake by this whole system?
Around, after they got the system in and thing going, I think Roy Kaler, I got the last information from him, and through a Mitchell Creek siphon, there was one time there he was pulling 240 acre feet through the Mitchell Creek siphon, and that went through the tunnel into Andelin Lake, about 240 acre feet a day.
Okay, that's quite a bit of water, to.
I think that only lasted just during the. Might say the spring runoff.
Yeah, yeah.
I think one thing, Scott, is people go up there and look at that, and it's always amazed me. And in those days, which, you know, the old times, they didn't have anything, how they could build back into that far country. And, of course, they had to build a road to go with it. And look at some of those flumes around the cliffs. You want to remember that wasn't mass-produced ahead of time. Each leg would have to be cut for each spot because you couldn't... Nothing was the same length or size or anything else, and I'm still amazed at what those people did in those days and actually how fast they would do the job and what a good job they would do.
Especially to have it stand up as long as it did.
Yeah, some of it's still there. I mean, some of you couldn't even get down, you know, some of that old flume. I mean, fire took a lot of it out, but the last few fires, but it's really amazing. I think when people go up and take a look at that country and just see how far they get back in there in those days.
If I were to drive into Anilon Lake today, would I have to look very hard to find remnants of the old flume and so on?
You won't find anything there.
No, on up above, you'd have a hard time seeing it. If you knew where it was, then you can see actually where it came around the hillside. You can still see a line occur on up above there. On the west side of Anilon Lake, you can see where it dumped in there for a long time before they built the tunnel. There's a wash coming into there and where it round around.
Well, you get on up going out of Gold Creek toward Poison. There's a stretch around there toward Camp 4, I think. Probably see a few the old legs still there. I don't know whether they've been burned out or not.
Yeah, they've been pretty well burned out. You can see where they're for a while before they put that Mitchell Creek siphon in where it came around too. But it's just if you know where to look, you can see the thing.
Newt, when all that was being built by the newly formed district in the 20s, who did the labor on it?
Oh, that a lot of it was done with just local contractors, but the main supply line from Anilon Lake into Grade Creek, most of that was built by Boblett and Sons from Wenatchee. They contracted that, and I had a clipping somewhere, haven't found it, but where they had taken the contract to build from Poison Creek. They took contract from Poison Creek to Gold Creek, about 3 miles there, and around $40,000.
Yeah. How many growers did it take to have, you know, to have the benefit of this water to be able to finance that kind of thing? Yeah, that was a big project. How was it financed?
There wasn't anybody signed up for it.
Well, I think it was a lot of it was a speculative deal still. I mean, it isn't when it started, it was speculative, and like a lot of projects, it goes broke, and that's why they had, you know, several of the bankruptcies in the district was formed. They, going back, or trying to remember in the minutes, I think they sold some bonds, mostly revenue bonds, and then gets rather complicated, but they just one thing about it, if you had water on a piece of land and you're raising an orchard and you don't pay and you don't get any water, then you don't raise any orchard. I mean, so you got a pretty good hold there without signing a bunch of papers, actually.
Yeah, right. But it wasn't something that could be paid for by the strictly by the growers through the rate for the water, you know, on a cash flow basis. They had to go out and find funding, right?
Right, they sold bonds, John, and from that they could capitalize over a period of years.
Yeah. Talking this morning with Ed Armbruster and Newt Griffith about the irrigation efforts in the Manson area. And we'll come back from the crockery and talk some more in a little while. Thank you very much, Steve. Talking, as we mentioned, with Newt Griffith and Ed Armbruster about irrigation efforts in the Manson area in the 1920s. Newt, did you do any work on that line, on any of those lines?
Yes, I did, because whenever I had a break up there, well, the farmers all went up and fixed it.
How often would that happen?
Well, you never knew. Mm-hmm. When a piece went out, well, it was go and fix it and get done, not fool around with any contracts or anything. Just go to some mill and get a load of lumber and take it up there, and a bunch of guys with hand saws and hammers go and shovels and repair it and get the water back in.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of that was, what was it, 69, when 68?
68,
the 4th of July fire. 4th of July fire. That took out and cut off all the east High Line, High Line 1 and 2, and some unplatted land. That burned out on Sunday afternoon, and Ed was at in the office. He got busy on the phone, contacted some pipe suppliers. Wednesday, the first pipe arrived to replace what was burned out. And in the meantime, the farmers and the reclamation crew with their equipment had a bed made, and they started laying pipe on Wednesday. And I know the main foreman on the work crew, he made a bet with one guy out there, bet a quart of whiskey that they'd have the water in by Friday. And, well, a bureau man, he says, oh, it's crazy, couldn't be done. Well, he bet him a quart of whiskey. At 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, they had water back in.
Is that right?
A little over 9,000 feet. They built the pipe bed because the flume was all burned out. Built a pipe bed, laid the pipe. A bunch of the farmers with their portable electric welders went in and welded together, and Wednesday, Friday afternoon, 4 o'clock, they turned the water in. And that's the way the cooperative deal or community deal was handled.
How many, do you guys, either one of you, have any idea how many miles of line was in that? Any guesstimate at all?
In the distribution line or
yeah,
what?
In the distribution line.
A little better than 17 miles.
Well, no, quite a bit above that. In the distribution, in the tire distribution lines, we had close to 70, I think, in the tire system. But see, out of the hills, there was 20-some from...
32.
32
come from Safety Harbor to Antelin.
Mm-hmm.
And there was about 2 miles from Antelin down before there was any water delivery. And then it was divided up into, well, a distribution line like a spider web. Just run everywhere and to get every acre that they could.
And when this was put in, most of it was open, right?
Yeah, up in the hills it was, yes.
Yeah.
So I think down the distribution, some of the smaller lines down there, they ended up in some... when it first put in, I think it was all open ditch then, or open flume. There was very little pipeline.
Well, they had one pipe on High Line 3 that come up toward the school where that was piped.
It seems as though with so much of it open, there'd be so many problems. Slides, tree falling into the line.
Well, there was. I mean, that was you always had slides, you always had breaks, you had the flume breaking. It was a continuous operation. You always expected something to happen, let's put it that way. And it usually did.
Yeah, it was almost as though you could never say it was completed. You were constantly fixing it, I would imagine.
Well, that was it. I mean, you expected... during the summertime, they're 24 hours a day. Of course, that's one reason why we ended up with the new system.
Yeah.
Well, when that is all, before they had the fires up on the supply line up there, the maintenance crew on that was 17 men. Took 17 men, and then it was busy. That is from Antelin Lake to Safety Harbor. 17 men, and they had various camps, a camp at Bear Wallow, one at Camp 4, one at Falls Creek, one at Camp 5, and fellows that lived there, mm-hmm. stayed there, and were maintenance men. They all they did was just walk up and down the flume morning and night and spot trouble, and the crew to do the repair while they followed up. And yeah. at one time, that crew, that maintenance crew up there, was 17 men. And then they were on 24-hour call.
Newt, tell me a little bit about what it was like to, in the daily operation of an orchard in 1920. What was different about it then as compared to now?
Well, those that were working for the district, they were on subject, they were subject to call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
With a pretty good wage, 25 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And the ditch walkers that were camped up in the various camps up there, they run around $60 to $80 a month. And each one of those ditch walkers would have, oh, approximately 2 miles. Maybe 2 miles on each side of their camp, so it would give them practically a 4 mile section to patrol and look for leaks and sag flumes and what have you.
When,
that's one thing they did, Scott. You know, you ask about breaks. They patrolled it constantly. I mean, every day they hit that, or maybe even twice a day. And so in a flume, if you had a leak start or something, they fixed it or got it fixed. So I think just a good preventive deal is what kept it. Of course, you go back up and look in the hills, you can see lots of places they did have washes and so forth. But they did work at it to try to stop it, because before they happened, and it saved quite a bit that way.
The main equipment that a ditch walker carried with him was a shovel, a hammer, a few nails, a caulking knife, and a sack of oakum. If there was a small leak or something, chuck it full of oakum and take a shovel and throw some dirt into the ditch and let that plug up just a little small leak.
Mm-hmm.
And but those fellows there, they were very, very reliable fellows, because they stayed right on the job all the time, and they were really interested. And in a lot of cases, there was a lot of them that were older fellows that had been on the project there for quite a while, and they'd quit orchard work and they were doing that to make sort of make the ends meet.
Mm-hmm.
It was only, well, they usually, the first ones go in usually in February.
Go in that early, huh?
Yeah.
What happened to this whole system in the wintertime?
Just let it set there in the snow and everything else. Weather have it out with it. And that's the reason that they always started up in February, because the flume would be full of snow. They'd get one of those little streams started down the flume and try to melt the snow out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're talking with Newt Griffith and Ed Armbruster this morning. At about, what is it here, 15 minutes until 10 o'clock. Chelan Photographics has a marvelous collection of Lawrence Lindsley photographs. And you'll find when you stop in and talk with Errol Andrews there that he'll be more than happy to show you the books of them. He has a couple of them, over 200 different prints from the area. Some of my favorites, well, a Field Hotel, for instance, from way back. Marvelous picture of the Field Hotel is in there. Some outstanding shots as well of the Manson and Chelan and Lakeside, the townsite areas. And if you're interested at all in the history of this area, it's a good idea to stop in and look them over. And if you want prints, why, Errol can do that for you, too. Errol Andrew at Chelan Photographics. We'll come back and talk some more from the crockery in a moment.
Remind me to put the commercials in there. Aaron Vick, the other day, talking about that line down the old Coyote Creek, you know. He said they used to put logs down there.
Yeah.
They also had tracks up there where they pulled up the material to build some of these niches. And built ahead of that, I was up there just about a half. I was up there when they had the timbers here quite a few years ago now. But some of that machinery, great big iron stuff, is built to the top of that.
You mean the Coyote Creek there?
Coyote Creek there.
Yeah.
Built to the top of that. You know, the massive steel wheels and everything. Had the timber sale, had a road fairly close. And when I walked down, and it's just a lot of that material still there.
Well, the tram up there, that was put in by Nicholson and Trunble to get logs down.
Yeah.
That's originally. And when they abandoned it, well, then when they built the Coyote Ditch up there, that was a cement lined ditch.
They haul the cement
and stuff up.
We were just talking about something that Vic Haight mentioned about an old line that went up in the Coyote Creek area. Ed, what was it that you were...
Well, this Vic mentioned they brought logs down that. And also, as Newt said, after the quit logging, they were put a concrete lining, the concrete ditch in that area, and they put a donkey up there, donkey engine, and had a tram and railroad tracks that they used to pull the concrete and stuff up that way to it. And we have a bunch of pictures out the reclamation of them logging that area, by the way. But I was in there, it's been quite a few years ago now, when they were logging that area, and some of that equipment and machinery still sits up there at the top of that tramway.
Newt, do you remember... Let me ask you about your own orchard operation in the 1920s. It had to be quite a bit different in operating an orchard than it is now. What was your daily life like then on an orchard?
24 hours a day.
Starting out with milking
the
cow.
Huh?
Starting out with milking the cow, I presume.
Yeah.
Well, yes. I planted my first orchard out there in 1921.
Mm-hmm.
And then I planted another one in 1922. And, of course, at that time, it was all real irrigated. You had your ditches, your little rills to maintain, and you had your cultivation to do. Most of the stuff you'd irrigate, and then you go and cultivate your ditch in, go get a dust mulch on top of your moisture and hold it in there. And that was usually most of the summer's work, was cultivation and irrigation. That's all you did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, your water, you had to take care of that 24 hours a day. And there wasn't no Saturday afternoons and Sundays off, because when you got your allotment of water there, you better stay home and take care of it, which probably be about once a month you got water, but you probably have it for a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the time you had your thinning to do and cultivation and such as that. But
what did you do for a labor force to harvest your fruit?
Well, in the early days there, I mostly was local. But some of the bigger outfits recruited mostly Indian labor from up in the Colville Reservation and from up around Carrimias, Canada. There used to be a lot of the Indians came down from Carrimias and out of the Colville.
Did the orchardists provide the housing for those people that they brought in and so on?
Wasn't no housing or anything. They brought their own tents and set up their own facilities wherever was necessary.
They worked out of camps that they'd set up themselves then?
Yeah. Well, there wasn't usually, we'd probably have maybe two or three. Well, we'd have two or three teepees or tents for a place to sleep, and they'd cook over an open fire.
How did you market your fruit then? What happened to it when you got it off the tree in the 1920s? Did you pack it yourself on your orchard or what?
Yeah, most of it was packed right on the orchard. I run a little list one time about that. And at one time, there was 70 different orchards or farmers out there that had their own packing shed. And they'd run one or two packers or three. And occasionally, well, there'd be two or three fellows go together and put up a shed and maybe pack two or three drawers of fruit there. And then it was all handled. A lot of it was, well, the old Manson fruit growers, that was the first co-op out there. And they built their first packing shed down where the BB shed, tool shed is there now, close to, right across from, or close to Jim Walls. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is the first co-op. I think there was 28 or 30 different growers in that. And they had sort of a sales organization, a fellow named Rand, and Buttles. They were more or less on as a sales organization and mostly on a commission base. And of course, they get the more they got for the fruit, the bigger their commission was.
Now, before you had that kind of an organization to work for, how did the orchardist, he could pack the fruit, but where did it go from there? Who did he sell it to?
Well, in the early days there, there was a few buyers that came into the country here. There was a Wagner outfit out of Chicago, and there's E. Wagner and Sons down in Wagnersburg, and Cochran from New York, and what is the American fruit growers now? Fruit growers, they were in here. And you ship that stuff. Well, you'd grow it and pack it and take it down and load it on the car, and then you get back what, after they got done with their takeoff, why, you got what is left, if there was any left.
Did you have your own labels?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them. There was a lot of them had their own labels. 1922, of course, the Lakeland Fruit Growers started then. Mm-hmm. That's Trout now. Mm-hmm. And they had started out with six growers and gradually built up to around 100 and some at the present time. And then Blue Chelan took over from what was the Van Slyke Holdings. Mm-hmm. And then Hubbard and Peterson started their packing shed out there and packing for various growers. That's now Manson Co-ops. Doug Ingram is the manager of that.
Did you know a fellow named Charles Robinson?
Yeah.
Okay. I've seen reference in some old newspapers to his shed burning out. Do you remember that?
It was over 25 Mile Creek, wasn't it?
I think so. I think so. If, as I recall, I wish I had the notes in front of me, but as I recall, he lost his entire packing shed and his entire crop, just about, in this fire. Do you remember that? About 1920? Two, somewhere in there?
I don't recall it just now.
Yeah.
I knew I was at the time.
At any rate, if that kind of thing happened to a grower, what kind of effort could he make in those early days to get back on his feet?
Just get out there and do his work himself, and maybe replant and go out and get a little job to get a few dollars to live on once in a while, and
do a little moonlighting, huh?
Moonlight to live on,
yeah.
You might say.
Yeah.
There wasn't any of this federal land bank loans and PCA loans and growers' credit and all that. There wasn't anything like that. You were out there and you were on your own, and you did the very best you could with what you had. And if you got a little bit of extra, well, you, instead of taking a trip to Hawaii, you maybe expanded your operation just a little bit so that you run on the thin edge all the time.
Yeah. I've also seen some reference in old newspapers and so on to, at various times, growers themselves making trips back east and looking for a market for their apples. How prevalent was that practice?
Well, it wasn't very much because they didn't know who they was going to see or anything. It was just more of a fly-by-night deal, and hoping that they'd find somebody on the way that, along the way, they'd go into the various markets. That's the way that Wagner's and Woolfolk and some of those people would contact them and get them to send one of their representatives into the area or something like that. But there were very few. Our first crops we raised out there, we shipped them all to Cochran in New York. Cochran Fruit Company in New York. They had a fellow that come in here every summer, and he'd go over your crop and kind of estimate what there was going to be, and usually come up with an offer of a base price. Any more than that, why, you just didn't know. They set that base price. Well, usually that base price was just enough to cover the transportation cost and the unloading at the other end.
Yeah. Now, also, one thing I wanted to be sure I asked you about, too, Newt, if you remember, is in 1921, a group of local men had built a fruit-drying plant in Chelan. Do you remember anything about that?
Yeah. Cardiff, wasn't it?
For years, there'd been talk about the need in the valley to have a fruit drying plant, which provided a more ready market for local growers, and would, you know, all kinds of dreams for it, that would provide a more stable market. You wouldn't have to ship all of your fruit all over the country. At least you'd have some sales capability here. But then it burned down right away, too. So.
No, I don't think it burned out. The fellow that was really at the head of it was Ira Cardiff from Yakima. And they finally developed a pretty good-sized plant out there and were capable of drying about 200 tons of fruit per day.
Where was this plant that you're speaking of located?
Well, if you're acquainted in the area out there, it'd be just below Ed Grimes' place.
Okay. Well, you're talking about a different one from me then. So I found out about another one.
I don't remember of any other dryer deal. There was a dryer deep here dealer in Chelan here.
That's the one I think I was thinking of.
Well, that was over right over here close to the City Hall. That was run by Von Schleich and Clark.
Okay.
That burned out.
Yeah. And then they had plans to rebuild it and put in a cannery and the whole works.
Yeah. Well, they did do some canning there.
How much of your crop as a grower in Manson would go into the local dryers business out there?
Well, all you send down there was, you might say, would be your culls.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that all depended on how warm they got, and unless you got a hail, how much hail you got on it, and climatic conditions would affect. Sometimes it didn't get them picked early enough and it'd be too ripe. It was, but I would judge it average around 10%.
Okay. Did that improve the financial standing of the grower to have that kind of a facility around? Appreciate.
Well, the only thing it did, it just gave them a few dollars early in the season. Most of these outfits, they'll pay around 2.5 ton for the fruit delivered at their door. Well, that didn't pay the farmer for taking his time to haul it down there and deliver it, because he, by the time you loaded it up and hauled it down there and got back home, you spent more time and effort than you would get out of it, but it was a place to get rid of it.
Yeah.
After those dryers went out there, well, then the valley got started down at the station there, and they provided an outlet for a lot of stuff, but still their prices, I don't think ever did get over $5 a ton.
Yeah.
Usually it was around 2.5.